Welcome to the Right Take Podcast, news, ideas, and conversations at the intersection of politics and culture, a project of the David Horowitz Freedom Center. I will be your host, Mark Tapson. Greetings, and welcome back to the Right Take Podcast. I am your host, Mark Tapson. We're going to get into a powder keg of a topic today, and that is racism. But not the kind of racism that the left keeps wanting us to have what they call a national conversation about. In fact, we have a national conversation about it every single day, it seems like. But the kind of racism they want to pretend doesn't exist, and that is anti-white racism. Last month, a white high school student in South Carolina was brutally assaulted by three black teammates at a Fellowship of Christian Athletes football camp. The attack was captured on video and left the victim with a severe concussion and bruises, leaving him likely to miss his senior football season. His attackers accused him of posting a racial slur online. He denies that, and there is no evidence to support it. Several students involved now face criminal charges, and the incident's being investigated as racially motivated, which, of course, it was. Also last month, a violent brawl occurred in downtown Cincinnati, some of which was captured, of course, in viral videos, because no one intervenes to break up violence anymore. Everyone either gangs up on the victim or stands around filming it so they can upload it to TikTok or WorldStar. The incident involved a predominantly black crowd attacking a white man and woman. The man was beaten and stomped upon by the cowards, while the woman was knocked unconscious by a black male. Five individuals have been charged with assault, aggravated riot, and felonious assault. It was shocking and clearly racially motivated, but a black Cincinnati councilwoman named Victoria Parks wrote, quote, "They begged for that beatdown. I'm grateful for the whole story," unquote. She took some heat on social media for that ugly comment, but later doubled down on it, stating, quote, "I wrote what I wrote," unquote. These are just a couple of incidents of a phenomenon that is becoming impossible to ignore, although the mainstream left-wing media pretend that it does not exist, as I said a moment ago, because it points an accusing finger at a long-standing reality that everybody with eyes to see is fully aware of, but which it is socially and politically forbidden to discuss, and that is racism against white people. My guest today is a scholar who has written a courageous book addressing this forbidden topic, and offering some clear-eyed and rational but politically incorrect solutions which this country, boiling over with racial tensions, desperately needs. So stay tuned. You do not want to miss this conversation. And don't forget to subscribe to The Right Take if you haven't already, so you don't miss any of the important, compelling conversations we're having here. Don't touch that dial. My guest today at the intersection of politics and culture is a senior fellow at the Claremont Institute, a former Deputy Assistant Secretary of the Interior of the United States, and a research fellow at Stanford University's Hoover Institution. He is the author of a very important book, which we're going to get into today and its relevance to current events. It's called The Unprotected Class: How Anti-White Racism is Tearing America Apart. Jeremy Carl, welcome to the Right Take Podcast.
Thanks so much for having me on, Mark. It's a pleasure.
Yeah, the feeling is mutual. Thanks for coming on. Your book, which came out just a year or so ago, is becoming more urgently relevant by the day, it seems like. But before we dive into it, tell us about your impending nomination to the State Department. That's kind of exciting.
Yeah, thanks. I mean, obviously, nothing is done until it is done, but I'm very honored that the president has nominated me to be an Assistant Secretary of State for International Organization Affairs. So I would be essentially handling all of our kind of doings at various international organizations, particularly the UN, working in close concert, obviously, with our ambassador there, who also has a nomination pending. So I'm looking forward to just being able to contribute to the administration again. It kind of takes me back to a little bit of an earlier period of my career, where I was worrying a little bit less about some of these domestic issues, and I spent quite a long time on international issues. Most notably, I spent almost a decade when I was at the Hoover Institution as the sort of right-hand man for the late George Shultz, the Secretary of State under Ronald Reagan. So got to see a lot of, got to talk to him a lot over the years about sort of how the State Department functions and kind of the interest that we have globally. And I'm excited to hopefully have the opportunity to put some of that into to kind of formal practice in the Trump administration.
Well, that's awesome. Congratulations. We'll keep our fingers crossed about that. First of all, anti-white racism is probably the most taboo topic in America. I have to give you major props for having the balls to address it in a book. What emboldened you to take on that inflammatory topic?
Well, thanks. It's a good question. And I think ultimately you're right, particularly when I was writing it and decided to write it, it was very inflammatory. And I just decided I was in a position, fortunately, where I could. I was in a position personally in my personal life, and I was fortunate to have an employer, as I still do, in Claremont Institute, which is incredibly supportive and encouraging of its fellows, kind of taking risks and then letting the chips fall where they may. And then I just thought it was a really incredibly important issue, and that people were not willing to talk about it. And so I could, and I did. Maybe if I'd known that I was going to have to go through the Senate nomination process at some point in the future, I would have stayed away from such a controversial topic. But, I felt that it was really important and that somebody needed to talk about it. So I just sort of put myself out there.
I agree. It's a very important topic. And I know from personal experience that whites who try to discuss anti-white racism are immediately just dismissed or mocked because, hey, slavery, what right do we have to complain? But in your book, The Unprotected Class, you argue that it's very real and has even become official policy in America. How do you see that manifesting itself?
Well, it's manifested in a million ways. And I think, you know, as I should say it as a side, one of the things that I kind of did very consciously as a strategy for the book, but also just in terms of I'm really pleased how it was received, is there is a, if you go to my Amazon page or whatever and you look at the complimentary reviews, it is a multicultural cast of endorsers. I didn't want to just write a book for a few white people to complain amongst each other about how bad things are. I didn't think that would be really useful. I wanted to write a book, and I actually say this, I think, early in the book, that it, you know, we kind of, this needs to be something that I can put it out here and we can at least have some level of agreement among a wide variety of Americans, or it just doesn't matter. So that was very much part of my thinking. How it's manifested, you can almost sort of say the reverse, which is if you look at what, in particular, the Civil Rights Division under Harmeet Dhillon, who's just doing an outstanding job as the Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights, is trying to undo under Trump, you see a lot of what I was kind of bringing to the fore, everything from, in fact, she just recently did something that I sort of regret not having put in there because it was so egregious, but everything from how the Small Business Administration discriminates against whites for loans to the various ways that affirmative action takes place to the quota systems to what you're seeing in college admissions where you have blatant anti-white and then also anti-Asian discrimination. I mean, the kind of interesting thing here is that a lot of this has been hiding in plain sight. And I've kind of joked previously when talking about this that, you know, honestly, if I were smarter in many ways, I might have written a book on a different subject. And I picked this one because I didn't need to be smart. I just needed to be a little bit brave. I just needed to, okay, this thing is right in front of me. There's certainly a lot of people who don't want you to talk about it, but all I have to do is just say, hey, you know, this thing, that this very open and blatant discrimination that's going on is wrong. And now what you're seeing in the Justice Department is just saying, oh, by the way, you know, all this stuff you're doing where you have this fellowship that effectively is for everybody but white people, that actually is a violation of the Civil Rights Act. And invariably, these guys are just folding because they know they don't have a case. And, you know, that's just that's kind of been just indicative of how bad things were, that they know once they're finally called out on it, that they don't really have a defense. And so I'm very incredibly pleased. I think it's been one of the biggest wins of the Trump administration is how much progress we've made here, but we've still got a long way to go.
You argue in the book, correctly, I might add, that anti-white racism undermines national unity Is that intentional on the part of at least some elements of the left to stoke division and tension and to, as Saul Alinsky put it, rub raw the resentments of the people?
Oh, absolutely. And again, I mean, I don't want to be too conspiratorial about this because I think for most people, they just sort of receive their politics from elected officials or whoever is writing and influencing them. Or a lot of people are kind of, I mean, I basically say this, are sort of dupes in the system in the same way that as your namesake of the David Horowitz Freedom Center has noted, you know, a lot of people were dupes of the communists back in the day without being communists. But there are a significant number of people who have actively looked at kind of how we can use anti-whiteness to splinter American unity, to turn Americans against each other. And because turning Americans against each other in that sort of a way, or really in any way, is a great way for a politician to seize power, sadly. So that's what they're ultimately interested in at the end of the day. And it's one of the reasons why they've pursued some of those policies and strategies that they have.
This gets back to you taking on this topic in the first place. How do you respond to critics who would like to shut down critics of anti-white racism, like yourself, by arguing that addressing it just risks inflaming racial tensions even more rather than resolving them?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I do think it matters how you do it. And I think if you go look at the reviews of my book, which are plentiful on Amazon and among the professional reviewers and elsewhere, one of the things I'm really pleased about is people talk about the book has a very reasonable, non-angry, non-polemical tone. And that was really quite intentional because I do respect that these are sensitive issues. And I think it's important that we talk about them in the right way. But I do think that it's also the second half of that is that it's important that we do talk about them. And that when you're not talking about them, you have a bunch of very, very angry people. And that anger builds up. And, you know, in many ways, it's justified. I'm not going to tell, particularly if you've talked as I do, to a lot of young white guys, and a couple of my older sons are sort of now in this position, kind of going out into the world, they have been left aside for so many opportunities very overtly, you know, as a matter of policy. Like, and again, these things are coming out where there are explicit things of, oh yeah, we're not going to interview white people for this, or white men at least. So if you don't talk about it, though, that rage and resentment just builds up, and then at some point it explodes, and that's not good for anybody. And so I kind of argue again in the book that talking about anti-white racism and coming to a better place on this, it's not just in the interest of white people, it's in the interest of every American, not just because we care about justice, but because we want social peace, social coherence. And the sorts of injustices that have been perpetrated are not going to be able to go on forever. Just as I might add, and again, I don't run away from any of the obvious history in America where we had other types of anti-minority racism. I fully acknowledge that obviously those things happened, but you know, to the extent that we would have never addressed them, things would have just gotten to a boiling point, right? And at times that did in fact happen. So I'm trying to avoid you know, any repeat civil wars or anything even resembling that.
Yeah, you argue also in the book that the civil rights movement's original goals of equality have been distorted to justify discrimination against whites. How is that? What's the most significant way that's played out over the last several decades? I guess affirmative action would be the most obvious example.
Sure. I think that's one. I think one of the biggest remaining pillars that the Trump administration has, I mean, again, they're beginning to go about it. I mean, Harmeet is very aware of this, but we still haven't fully gotten rid of it. And we're probably going to need the Supreme Court to really finalize this. But I think one of the most dramatic ways in which we saw this go off the rails is in what's called so-called disparate impact legislation. And that's a thing that not a lot of people know about, but actually colors so much of hiring, a whole bunch of other things. And basically what it is it arises from a case called Griggs versus Duke Power that came before the Supreme Court in 1971. And it just, again, the lawyers here will excuse me for kind of paraphrasing a little bit loosely, but basically what happened is there was a test that they gave to some of their employees to determine certain types of advancement. And there was no even allegation that the test had been given in a, for a racially discriminatory purpose, but it had a racially disparate outcome in terms of who passed it, i.e. in this particular case, white applicants were much more likely to pass the test than African Americans. And so the Supreme Court ruled that this had a disparate impact on African Americans. And therefore, unless you hopped through a bunch of these hoops, using that type of a test would become illegal. That also just sort of then practically manifested itself in case law, such that if you have a reference population who are applying for jobs and they have a certain demographic, and then you wind up with a substantially different demographic in terms of who you end up ultimately hiring, you are potentially liable. And again, there's all sorts of permutations and details here that I'm glossing over, but you potentially liable for violation of the Civil Rights Act. And so what has happened as a result of that is that people, institutions have kind of put in informal racial quota systems to avoid that sort of a risk, or they avoid putting in tests, even when those tests might be quite relevant to job performance. And the reason why I kind of go into disparate impact as a particularly pernicious element of the regime is that was 1971 when that case was argued. If you go back and you actually read the congressional debates around the 1964 Civil Rights Act, when the specter of this type of action was suggested, oh, that might happen, everybody, all the proponents said, oh, no, of course, we're never suggesting that. This would clearly be wrong. You know, it would be totally against what we're trying to doing. 7 years later, the Supreme Court ruled on it, and it was the law of the land. And so, you know, that just sort of shows how quickly things really did go off the rails with a lot of the civil rights activities.
What about the role of the news media and our cultural elites in normalizing anti-white sentiment? How has their politically acceptable rhetoric exacerbated things?
Yeah, well, that's been huge. And one of the things that I distinguish in my book is sort of formal versus informal anti-white racism. So you have a lot of the formal things. That's what we've been talking a lot about. But there's also just sort of the zeitgeist within the culture, the way the media talks about things, the way Hollywood talks about things. And as I document in The Unprotected Class, this has been really pernicious. I mean, you have things down to, there's actually a Twitter feed called White People Are Stupid in Commercials that's entirely dedicated to kind of documenting how these ads are constantly being run with white people, and particularly white men, being really, really dumb and being saved by some minority. Again, we have the same name for this same phenomenon, which exists in Hollywood. An African-American critic kind of termed this the numinous Negro as a way of talking about sort of this black character who will kind of come in as almost a trope to save the benighted white people from their awfulness. Again, you see this sort of throughout the Hollywood, and then you go to the news media and you see how often crime, say George Floyd situation being, I think, probably one of the more dramatic elements of this, or Trayvon Martin, or these things where any white on black incident, I don't even want to call them a crime because in many cases they're not, is treated as evidence of America's systemic racism. Whereas the much more common incidences of particularly black on white crime, but even Hispanic on white crime, are kind of brushed under the rug by at least the establishment media. I mean, the right media, leading media will sometimes talk about them. This is just the environment. This is the sea that we've all been swimming in. And again, it's been really negative because people look at this. I mean, there's many reasons it's negative, but one is that people look at this and they see that it doesn't correspond to reality in any way. And so it causes, again, a huge amount of understandable resentment.
Yeah, and speaking of interracial violence, you wrote in the book that a great deal of interracial violence, of which whites are disproportionately and increasingly victimized, has this undertone of racial revenge to it. And I thought a perfect example of that is this recent controversy in Cincinnati over the white couple that was beaten by a predominantly black crowd. There was a city councilwoman who said that the couple deserved that beatdown, but she later stated something that I thought was really interesting. She said, and I'm going to quote her here, "Never start a fight with a white person, but if they hit you first, that becomes a reason for all of the frustration and hurt and terror of generations, historical generational pain to be released," unquote. Now, I don't know who started that Cincinnati brawl, but it sounds to me like she's saying racial revenge against whites is justified because what she calls generational pain has to be released or unleashed.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I'd seen a little bit of her comments, but I hadn't heard that comment about generational pain. And yeah, I mean, it is fascinating because stripped of all of the kind of flowery language, what she's basically saying is, well, if a white person starts it, you're justified in beating them up or, you know, kind of doing extreme violence to them because of, you know, some alleged thing that their ancestors may have done, even though, of course, I mean, I obviously reject this entire concept out of hand, but just even as a factual matter, right? Like, for all this person knows, I mean, you know, this white person could be an immigrant or their parents could be immigrants to the United States. They had nothing to do with any historical racism whatsoever. So even if you accept their flawed concept, which you shouldn't, it's kind of absurd as a historical matter. But yeah, I mean, when we have that type of language and justifications for anti-white violence being used, it just sort of shows you how you are. And of course, if any white person attempted to justify disproportionate violence from a white person against a black person, even in retaliation for like, oh, you know, the black person hit them first, they would quickly be drummed out of office. And by the way, appropriately, I mean, appropriately so. But this Congress or this Cincinnati councilwoman who said this, I feel pretty confident in saying, is not likely to pay a huge electoral price. Look, I mean, I'd be delighted to be wrong. And that there has finally been, it's very rare this sort of case even gets the sort of mainstream sympathetic attention that it gets. It's almost unprecedented, quite frankly. But I still doubt that somehow this is going to end with her resigning from office or anything like that. I'd be very surprised to see that.
Does anti-white racism kind of tangentially target Jews and Asians as well? Because in this, the perspective of Marxist power dynamics, those two minorities don't really fit in the matrix of intersectional victimhood. They're essentially considered white, right?
Well, white or white adjacent in the case of Asian Americans, and white adjacent being a kind of term the left likes to use. I mean, it's of course totally nonsensical if you think about it for even a second, but white adjacent simply meaning that, like, oh, by the way, they seem to generally be doing well. So we have to, you know, we have to excuse their lack of pathologies by coming up with this white adjacent category. It does. And again, one of the distinctions I try to draw in the book is there is some anti-white racism, a significant amount, probably even most, I would argue, that is really targeting whites qua whites, as it were, like whites as whites. And then there is some of it that is simply directed at, okay, we are going to be, you know, I don't want to throw around terms like communists or socialists, but since Mom Donnie is doing well in New York, maybe it's okay these days. But essentially, we have that type of extreme equalitarian outlook on the world, extreme, you know, that everything needs to be not an equality of opportunity, but an equality of outcome. And therefore, anybody from any group that is doing better, whether that be Jews, whether that be Asians, whether that just be non-Hispanic whites in general, that stands out from that, well, we need to kind of cut down that growing tall tree. So that does happen. And so I do try to distinguish within the book between sort of anti-white things and then anti-merit things in which white people are being swept up because they tend to still, despite some of this discrimination, be doing you know, better than some other groups on average for many things.
We've talked some about the various incarnations of anti-white racism, but what is the end game?
Yeah. So one of the things I argue in the book, and this is sort of one of the more provocative claims, I do really think ultimately the end game, and now I need to distinguish here, the vast majority of political actors who are not that sophisticated, including, I would argue, some elected officials who are not that sophisticated, they're just sort of reading from the script that is being handed to them or that is in front of them, and they don't sort of have this kind of end game in mind. But I think for the more sophisticated anti-white players out there, the kind of Al Sharpton types, right, if you will, particularly the historic Al Sharpton, they are seeking to kind of build this narrative of kind of white devilhood, for lack of a better term, to justify reparations and expropriation. Those may be literal, and they may be called reparations, or they might have some other name that they're being called, but it still functionally works the same way. It's providing an intellectual justification for expropriating the resources of others, right? Like in America, we can't just go around and say in general, well, I'm taking this other person's stuff because I can and I want it. In some societies, I've lived in other parts of the world and traveled in other parts of the world, you almost don't need more justification than that. In the US, we have a little bit of a higher bar that would be sort of be seen as not acceptable. So what you need to do is create a sort of narrative that, well, really, yes, we're doing this, but it's because white people deserve it. And so I think so much of this academic and quasi-academic literature around critical race theory and everything like that is ultimately, that's its functional use, is to justify that type of expropriation over the long term.
Now, haven't we already been paying out reparations for decades in the form of welfare programs and quotas and affirmative action and things like that, much of which have gone to people who aren't even descended, as you suggested earlier, from those who were actually harmed?
Right. Well, this is a good question, and it's actually not one that I get very often, but I think you're absolutely right in that you can see correctly a lot of these programs we had in the past as, yeah, they're functionally reparations programs. I do think that, again, the character of them was much less pernicious at first. You know, when you look at the civil rights era, regardless of what you think about civil rights laws, et cetera, there was clear and unambiguous legalized racial discrimination going on that affected various parties, you know, before the 1960s that definitely kept them away from some opportunities. If you're going to turn around and say, well, you know, we're now going to try to even up the scales for you because you personally were actually victimized by this situation, we can argue about the wisdom of doing that or not, but I think it's certainly a very different animal than, well, your grandfather was discriminated against racially, and therefore there's some sort of inherent debt owed to you, especially if, in many cases, as you point out, it's not even your grandfather, because in many cases, we're talking about the beneficiaries of these sorts of programs being immigrants of various sorts who've been had nothing but been given really great opportunities as a result of their families having come here. So again, you know, whatever sort of quasi-reparation could have been justified based on going back to individuals who had actually been harmed, you know, in the 1950s or 1960s, when these issues began to get live, certainly 60, 70 years later, when we're talking about totally different groups of individuals, the logic just doesn't apply.
Yeah. And you mentioned in the book that attempting to make sense of reparations using logic and facts actually misses the point, because the quest for reparations is purely a racial shakedown.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Right. And again, there's different levels of kind of awareness of the shakedown, even among the people doing the shakedown almost. But yeah, I mean, this is about, it's about money. It's about power. It's about what can I get for my group? And in fact, there's lots of evidence showing that, again, empirical evidence from studies done by left-leaning academics that white people almost uniquely in America have a very low in-group preference And in fact, it's interesting because when you decompose that, pretty much the vast majority of groups have some in-group, what we call an in-group preference for their in-group, meaning, you know, they have some preference for their group and how they think about their group in the world. As long as this doesn't go completely out of, you know, kilter, there's nothing that's pathological or disturbing about that. It's kind of what we would expect for any group. The one group that is the huge exception to this among all ethnic groups and all ideologies is white liberals. And white liberals have a decided out-group preference, which is to say that when you measure on a variety of metrics, they really dislike white people, or at least they claim to. And they think that white people are just worse in pretty much every respect than minorities. This is a really psychologically aberrant sort of phenomenon. You don't see this again with any other group of any other ideology. I'm not even aware of it in other countries, although I suspect you might see some of the same thing with liberal white Europeans. But you do have this going on. And in fact, although it's been put a little bit aside by my nomination, my kind of follow-up book that I'm working on is kind of looking at the white left and how they have been a sort of uniquely damaging part of this process. And again, I don't even think you can talk about anti-whiteness in America without significantly implicating some subset of these white people themselves.
Yes. Well, I'll look forward to that book. And what about this, speaking of lack of logic, what about this nonsensical trend of land acknowledgments? How do those fit into the whole racial shakedown?
Yeah, I mean, this has been a particular thing of mine. In fact, even in my own life, I was on the board of the State Humanities Council here in Montana, which is essentially the arm of the National Endowment for the Humanities. And we were starting our meetings with a land acknowledgement. And a land acknowledgement, for any of your listeners who don't know, is you basically say, well, we're on the traditional lands of, and then you list, a bunch of native groups that at least at some time have had some claim to be on here. So there's a million things wrong with it. And even the left has sort of criticized it. There's a million things that you can do, different directions that you can criticize it for, but the left has sort of said, well, it doesn't actually do anything, and it doesn't actually, maybe going back to our just previous conversation, doesn't actually hand over any resources, so it's very performative. But I'd say the bigger problem with it is, it's like, what groups are you even talking about? Pretty much the entire history of territory and conquest throughout the world is, you know, people taking things by varying degrees of force. And when you talk about some native group being here and this is their traditional lands, well, they displace some other group. And in fact, in the US, we still have enough history that we can even identify in some cases when a group on its so-called traditional lands displaced some other group for which it was their traditional lands. So you start there, but then there's other, to me, even more pernicious elements of it, in which there's a sort of feeling that somehow what was built in America is just a function of, white people showed up and this land was so great that the land itself magically created all these wonderful things for white people. Whereas in fact, of course, the kind of settlement and development of that land was something that took enormous sacrifices on the part of, and again, I'm oversimplifying a lot, but predominantly kind of white people of European descent who settled these lands, who developed these lands, who built these lands. At times, of course, there were things like treaty violations and other things for which, we can talk about it. And I'm not suggesting that we push that history under the rug, but the kind of notion behind a land acknowledgement is, well, white people basically stole everything here and all of this great bounty is just because of theft. Whereas in reality, regardless of one's views on property and theft, the vast majority of what we have in America today was built by white people of European descent who built it off the sweat of their brow and their ideas and their innovations and working often in very inhospitable areas, certainly Montana, where I live, being a prime example of this. And when you start talking about land acknowledgments as if the land has some sort of magical power, you know, that becomes a big problem.
We touched on this a little bit earlier, but in the Trump era, the cultural and political tides seem to be turning, and most, if not all, of the far left agenda seems to be undergoing deconstruction and even demolition. What impact is Trump having on the momentum that the left had built up in terms of things like DEI policies and critical race theory and education and all that? Is anti-white racism on its way now to being marginalized?
So the answer to the two different parts of that question, which is two different parts, is very different. So what Trump has done, it's just been amazing. I mean, again, like even my optimistic views for what we might accomplish, I mean, he really has rolled back. And again, it's been due a lot of work of the folks in the White House, and then a lot of great work from civil rights and Harmeet Dhillon and her team, who are basically just saying, and it's, again, it's a compelling American message. I mean, Harmeet's just getting out there and saying, I'm going to apply the law truly equally. Like, we're not going to discriminate against anybody based on their race or their religion or whatever. We're not going to allow violence based on race and religion. And that sounds like maybe the same thing that these other guys have maybe said in the past, but in reality, whites in particular were a big carve out for that. And what she's saying is whites and Christians and other groups that had sort of been exempted from that rhetoric before in practice, now they're going to be included. And so it's just been a sea change. So that's the great news, is that we're getting wins that I thought, even optimistically, knowing they wanted to push, we would never get, or at least we would not have them 6 months into this administration. The downside is, I do worry about a little bit about complacency. What I think has happened right now is the left is a boxer. They maybe haven't fought in a while. They've been knocked back on their heels because they're just not used to even having fought. I mean, the right has for so long just preemptively surrendered on these issues, even when we didn't need to, the left has kind of just gotten a little fat and lazy. But they're going to come back and they're going to push back. And especially when they get back in office, and they will someday, you know, I hope it's not anytime too soon in the White House, but it'll happen. And they're going to push back on some significant degree of this. And we need to be ready for that because they are not giving up by any stretch. Now, what I think we need to do, I think the good news is the message that we ultimately are trying to sell, which is discrimination on the basis of race is wrong, is a good American message that people agree with. And you even see in California where they would shoot down affirmative action by very significant numbers, despite an affirmative action ballot initiative, you know, outspending its opponents 100-1, and Joe Biden carrying California by 24 points or whatever it is. And then the affirmative action initiative loses by 10 points. I think we do have a popular message here, and I think there will be some reticence on the part of the left to claw back everything that they've lost, because I think they're going to realize that some of it is just really unpopular, and they're probably relieved that it got out of the way. But they're going to get a lot of, they're going to claw back a lot of it, or they're going to try. And I think the other thing is, right now we're sort of in this happy medium point where we've said we're going to do all these things, but we haven't actually seen the empirical consequences of, like, oh, we're not going to discriminate by race anymore. So hiring is going to start to look a lot different. And maybe criminal justice starts to look a lot different, because we're not sort of at least implicitly saying, okay, well, you're from a disadvantaged community, so we're going to cut you a break in sentencing or something like that. When the actual rubber hits the road and people see what this looks like, then the conversation is going to be a little tougher for us. I don't think it's wrong. I don't think it's a losing political bet for us, but it is going to be obvious that there are winners and losers in no longer discriminating by race. And so when that happens, I think we'll have some more challenges. So it's incredible that we're getting these wins, but we need to not be complacent and think that it's just all smooth sailing from here.
Exactly. Let's talk briefly about solutions. What are a couple of solutions on both a policy level and on a more personal level? In other words, things that quote unquote ordinary people could do to push back against anti-white discrimination.
Yeah, well, I talked on the policy level about disparate impact stuff. And again, the administration's working on it. Again, I have a list of a whole bunch of things that I suggest in the back of the book, and the administration has really made very significant steps on most of those things. But I think disparate impact is a big pillar. I think some of these things on the policy that we talked about with the Small Business Administration or a million different areas in government where we have overt racial discrimination going on as part of the law. Oh, that's just how we did it. All that needs to be eradicated. There's, you know, executive orders, there's laws. I think obviously if we pass laws, that's obviously the best way to do it. Although I'll certainly take executive orders, particularly if they're just repealing other executive orders. On a more informal level, I think it's really, and this is a lot of why I wrote the book, it's just people standing up and saying, we're not going to take this. And I think one of the great things about Trump is that through his boldness and through his administration's boldness, he has empowered a bunch of people to who maybe were cowed in the past. So, you know, can we say this? Can we believe in this? To speak out and say, hey, you know, we're not going to let Hollywood just willy-nilly portray white people in a kind of negative way, or we're not going to let this award ceremony or this media thing, we're gonna treat it in the same way that if you were to mock some other group as a generality. I'm not talking about, oh, there can't be humor, I mean, God forbid, but you know, if you're really systemically degrading you know, a group, that like, we're going to call that out and say, like, that's not acceptable for you to systemically degrade white people in this way, to talk about white people in a very negative way as a generality, right? Like to just say like all white people are like this. That's not okay. So I think that's the sort of informal element. And I think part of what we need to do that is we need to be armed with information. We need to be armed with the facts. That's why I wrote The Unprotected Class, because it is very much a just the facts, ma'am type of book about what has been going on. And I just tried to lay out a persuasive case for why we should stop that.
Good advice. Jeremy, where should people go online to keep up with your commentary and what you're up to?
Sure. So you can find me on my Substack is jeremycarl.substack.com, called The Course of Empire. I'm most active on X/Twitter. I'm Real Jeremy Carl there, and in general, I'm publishing in a bunch of different conservative outlets. But if you follow there, I will post the vast majority of work that I do there. And then obviously, if I'm fortunate enough to be confirmed, you may see some of the work I'm doing in the government. But we'll see how that all plays out.
Yes, good to know. Jeremy Carl, thanks for joining us today at The Right Take. Great book. Best of luck with the Senate nomination.
Thanks so much, Mark. It's a pleasure to be on.
And thank you, listeners, for joining us. I urge you to check out Jeremy's book, The Unprotected Class, follow him on social media, and don't forget to subscribe to The Right Take if you haven't already. And if you like what you hear, please leave that positive review. Be seeing you. The Right Take with Mark Tapson is a project of the David Horowitz Freedom Center and Front Page Magazine. Unauthorized reproduction of this podcast without express written consent is prohibited.